a good friend of John Monteith, I think, for more than half my life now. Mm. I was very lucky to join John straight after my postgraduate work when he was just beginning his academic career at Nottingham. So it's a real pleasure to have John sitting here in my house in Oregon, overlooking the Willamette Valley. We're looking across towards the Cascades in bright sunlight on a beautiful November morning. And John, welcome here.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking to you about your life. So why don't we start with the childhood phase? Tell us a bit about where you started and especially about how you first got interested in science. When's your first memory of science?
Right. Well, to begin at the very beginning, I was born in St. Margaret's Manse Fairley in September 1929. My father was a minister of the Church of Scotland, and my mother had been an English teacher in Glasgow. And I don't remember anything about St. Margaret's Manse because we left there when I was about 3 years old and moved up to Renfrewshire to Bridge of Weir, and it was from there that I went to school. My first school was Paisley Grammar School, and I started in the second year there. My mother taught me during my first year so that I wouldn't have to travel in the bus when I was only 5 years old. So I had a pretty thorough grounding in the basics of arithmetic and reading and everything else at Paisley Grammar School. I only had one science lesson there, but I still remember it very clearly. Towards the end of the final year in the primary school, we were taken over one day to the senior school, and one of the masters made a thermometer, which I was really amazed at. He just had a bit of glass tubing, and he melted the end in a Bunsen flame and blew it out into a little bulb, and then heated the bulb up and got mercury into it as the thing cooled down, and demonstrated that this worked as a thermometer. So I often wonder whether that was really a very significant kind of experience for me. But I wasn't able to stay into the senior school at Paisley Grammar School because, unfortunately, my father had developed multiple sclerosis and had to give up his charge in Bridge of Weir. And so we moved to Edinburgh when I was about 11 years old, and he died shortly after that. But I've skipped over another very significant event, which I think was even more important than the thermometer in deciding the course of my future career. And it's such a simple thing that I'm amazed now that it should have had so much influence on me. But one day I was playing in our large manse garden, as I often did, and happened to be up near the bonfire, which was as far away from the house as possible, of course, and all sorts of rubbish lying on this bonfire, including things that should never have been put on it for burning. And one of these was a 3-pin plug. And for some reason I picked this up and I took it back to the house and I got hold of a screwdriver and took the bottom off it and looked at all these terminals and things. And then I got some bits of wire and some batteries and flashlight bulbs and was interested to see how you could get current through the prongs of a plug and things like that. And then one of my parents' friends gave me an electricity set. And I did all sorts of things with that, and I got a chemistry set, and then tried playing with that. And a neighbour, a very good friend of the family, who was an extraordinarily skilled amateur craftsman, gave me a number of things that he'd made over the years, or collected over the years, which really started me off. There were a couple of pairs of old earphones. There was a voltmeter that he'd made. There was an induction coil into which you could put at the primary end 2 or 3 volts, and the other end you produced very spectacular electric shocks.
So your friend's hair stands up.
That's right. Well, not quite, but you could line up about five or six of your friends holding hands and electrocute them all simultaneously. So another thing that was also very significant was a microphone. And it so happened that our wireless had an input at the back for a gramophone, and you were able to plug the microphone in and broadcast to the rest of the family. So we used to do that from time to time. And interestingly enough, one of the people whom I did most of my broadcasting with in his home in Glasgow was Ian Cuthbertson, who my cousin, Ian Cuthbertson, who became a very famous Scottish actor and producer. So I always claim that I had a hand in his early steps onto the stage. So that that takes us really past the early introduction to little bits of scientific equipment, the early interest and enthusiasm for gadgets and things of that kind, and the start of my time at Heriot's.
So you moved to Edinburgh and you went to George Heriot's school.
Yeah.
Now that was a school with a sort of a great tradition in many of the sciences. I mean, were you sort of decided at that stage that the physics side was the area you wanted to go down?
Yes, I suppose so. Again, it seems a rather strange coincidence that I should have ended up at a school that had a strong physics tradition. The reason was simply that my mother had taught there in the 1920s after she had finished at Murray House. And she kept in touch with some of the staff, and so it wasn't too difficult to get in. I, of course, enjoyed particularly the physics and chemistry, but I was reasonably good at all subjects, and I don't think I decided till fairly near the end of my time that it was going to be physics and not chemistry, because I had continued to play around quite a bit with chemicals, and some of them were of the type that make loud bangs, and I shudder to think now of the way in which I used to take these things in the wet condition to school and put them on the radiator so they would go off during class in the case of nitrogen triiodide with a puff of purple smoke, which is very impressive. And the source of all these chemicals was a shop which you will remember, I think, from your Edinburgh days, called E.H. Baird, just opposite McEwen Hall. Yes. And there were two men there, they seemed to us to be very old men, but they probably were in their 40s, from whom we could buy anything. And I used to take home in my school bag bottles of concentrated sulfuric acid, concentrated nitric acid, mercury, you name it. So it really was a wonder that I survived, and my friends who used to dabble in these chemical experiments with me also survived. The things we found were quite extraordinary. I remember once in a waste field beside a garage near our house finding a tin of calcium carbide. So I looked this up in my book and found that you could make acetylene with it, and acetylene could be lit. So I got hold of a tin and punctured a hole in the lid and put the acetylene in with some water. And then, fortunately, from a reasonably safe distance, I applied a light. Now, what I hadn't reckoned on, of course, was that a mixture of acetylene and air is highly explosive. And there was a terrific bang, and the lid of the tin flew up over the roof of the house. If I'd waited a few minutes longer, I might have had a blue flame, which is what was intended.
You probably remember at Nottingham when we were both there. There used to be that annual lecture, didn't there, where they used to sit.
That's right.
That explosion, and everybody would sit on the edge of their seats, knowing it was going to explode at any minute. Did you still fiddle with bits of electrical apparatus in your days as a schoolboy in Edinburgh?
Yes, I did, I think, and one in particular I remember because it was a bit of the equipment that I entered for an applied science prize. It was also highly lethal in its own way, although you wouldn't think so from the fact that it was simply a device for maintaining constant temperature in a developing dish. I got very interested in photography and did my own developing and printing and eventually enlarging. And in a cold Edinburgh attic, it was often a problem keeping the temperature up. So I devised a system with mercury inside a glass tube. I suppose I must have remembered my Paisley Grammar School experience. And there were electrical contacts on the end of this. And I made a little solenoid which operated from the contacts. And when the solenoid was switched on, it closed a circuit that switched on an electric light bulb underneath the developing dish. And this really worked reasonably well, but of course the combination of water and open contacts at mains voltage and all the rest of it was not really very safe. I did, however, get the prize, so it was worth it.
Quite remarkable how small boys survive in this sort of thing.
I remember once reading in a book of Will Hayes that there is a special department of Providence that looks after small boys.
One of the features of the Scottish educational system, of course, is the breadth of subjects that was covered. Was that something you enjoyed at Heriot's, or were you very focused?
No, I think I was a reasonable all-rounder. Right up to the sixth form, I took English and Latin along with mathematics and physics and chemistry. And I enjoyed these art subjects too, and I think that they were very good training for what came later, all the writing and the careful choice of words, and knowing the Latin derivations of words, of course, is often extremely useful when you're trying to find le mot juste and you're not exactly sure which is which. There were quite a number of extracurricular activities too, like acting and public speaking. They had a public speaking prize that I tried for a number of times, and I never realized at the time how valuable that training was going to be later on when I came to be a university teacher and was traveling around the country a good deal giving talks about my work. I think during the time I was at Nottingham, for example, I reckoned I had spoken at every university in England and Scotland and Wales.
One thing you haven't mentioned is biology, which in terms of your sort of degree.
Yes. Well, there was a good biology department at Heriot's, of course, but in the first year, biology consisted mainly of drawing things. And art was absolutely my worst subject. I was almost totally hopeless. And I hated trying to draw frogs' legs and pigeons' wings and leaves and things like that. So I gave up biology after the first year and was never attracted to it again, curiously, in view of what happened later.
And the other thing we should say a little bit about is music, because that's an important part of your life.
Yes,
did that start way back when you were very small?
Yes, I think so. Both my mother and father were musical and encouraged me. And I began music lessons, piano lessons, when I was about 10 years old or so, and continued with them right up to the time when I left school. And after that, I started having organ lessons. I've continued to play the piano and the organ in a very amateurish kind of way ever since, and have also done quite a bit of singing in various choirs at different times. It is important to me, very important.
Yes. Well, let's move on and talk about as you finished at Heriot's and decided what you were going to do at university.
Yeah. I don't remember ever having a very great conflict in choosing my university career, although my undergraduate career, though looking back on it now, the course was extraordinarily narrow. I decided to do the honours physics course, which was probably more or less the same then as it was when you came along about 15 years later. This consisted of physics, mathematics, and mathematical physics three subjects for 2 years, and then physics in the third year, physics in the fourth year. So by the kind of standards of breadth that you find today in most university courses, I think that was really rather narrow. But I did enjoy the physics particularly. The mathematical physics I found difficult, and some of the mathematics I found extraordinarily difficult. I found it even more difficult because I had a girlfriend at the time who was in the same class, who was a very brilliant mathematician, and she always used to finish things in tutorials ages before I did. That wasn't a very comfortable experience. But the bit of the physics course that I really enjoyed very much was the practical work, especially in the third and fourth years when you were given a certain amount of freedom to develop things in the experiment that weren't in the standard sheet telling you what you ought to do. And that was, I suppose, where I really started the elements of research, from branching out a little bit on my own.
Was it clear which branches of physics were the ones you thought you were going to specialise in?
Well, yeah, it did come to me eventually that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life cooped up in a laboratory. I remember one long hot summer in the optics lab, which you remember was completely blacked out, feeling that I was terribly cut off from the real world. And against that, I had tremendously enjoyed the lectures both in heat and thermodynamics and in meteorology from James Payton, who influenced a lot of people, I think, who passed through his hands. And it really is to him that I owe the fact that eventually I decided to specialise in that area of physics.
At the time, and even now, of course, meteorology is very much a sort of part of the physics department, and was it just James Payton?
It was only James Payton, I think he had a secretary perhaps to help him. His own line of research was in the Aurora, of course, and he had set up a network of cameras in Scotland for taking photographs of the Aurora Borealis, including the attic of his own house, which I visited recently, by the way. His daughter still lives there, yeah, in Abernethy. And the equipment is all there, just exactly as it was when he died. He was a very major influence, and he was the only person there. And when you consider that even now there is only two departments of meteorology in the country, but one of them is a very small one in Edinburgh, and one of them is a very powerful one in Reading. It was just extremely fortunate, I think, that I went to a university where meteorology was taught, even in a small way. I have never regretted my decision to become a meteorologist, or a kind of meteorologist, and I can't imagine that I could have been as happy or as productive in any other field.
Let's talk a bit about that decision then. You were finishing in physics at Edinburgh and trying to decide, yeah, what to do and where to go, I suppose.
Yes.
What was your mind?
I was advised that it would be a good idea to move away to another university, and I couldn't really have done a higher degree in meteorology anyway. They didn't have the facilities at Edinburgh. But I wasn't at all sure what kind of meteorology I wanted to do. The only major meteorology department in the country at that time was at Imperial College. And I was very fortunate to get a DSIR studentship, which allowed me to go there in 1951. It so happened that in 1951, just a few weeks after I graduated, the British Association was meeting in Edinburgh, and the president of the British Association that year was Sir David Brunt, and he had brought with him as his secretary and assistant one of his newly joined members of staff, a young man called John Mason. So this was my first introduction to two of the members of the Imperial College team. it still wasn't quite clear what I would do with a PhD in some aspect of meteorology. But it so happened that I was talking one day about this question to an uncle of mine, David Cuthbertson, who was the director of the Rowett Research Institute in Aberdeen. That's an institute for animal nutrition. And he suggested to me that there might be some openings for someone to work in agricultural aspects of meteorology. And that idea quite appealed to me, that here was a way of using the physics in the open air for the benefit of food production, and it seemed an interesting challenge.
Did he know at the time whether there were people working in that area? Was he something known?
I think he knew that Penman was working at Rothamsted, probably, because he suggested to me that Rothamsted was a place that I ought to go. So I set off in the autumn of 1951 for London. I was fortunate to get digs in Ealing, and used to travel on the Piccadilly line every day into South Kensington. That experience decided that I never wanted to have a job in London, incidentally. I very well remember sitting down the first morning at Imperial College with the group of about 11 or 12 of us who were in the year. And a number of them have remained friends ever since, people like Brian Tucker, for example, who went to Australia. Keith Big also was an Australian. But what none of us, I think, appreciated at the time was that there was a quite extraordinary, unique concentration of meteorological talent in that department. And that with a staff student ratio of almost 1-to-1 or thereabouts, we were really getting extraordinary high level of personal contact.
Just go through the list,
individuals.
John.
Well, I hope I can remember them all, but there was Sir David Brunn himself, of course, who was a very eminent meteorologist and was, at that time, 1951, the physical secretary of the Royal Society. And then his second in command was Peter Shepherd, of the Shepherd Cup anemometer, who'd done some pioneering work in turbulence. There was E.T. Eady, who was a very famous dynamical meteorologist who sadly died quite young and whose lectures I'm afraid I found totally incomprehensible, but people like Brian Tucker, who went on to be dynamical meteorologists, enjoyed them very much. He also was a man who got completely carried away in his lectures, and I still remember how on one occasion, after he'd been lecturing for an hour and 45 minutes, we started shuffling our feet gently, and he looked up really rather annoyed and said, what's the matter, we've still got 15 minutes to go before the end of the hour. He had no idea.
He got right for life in those days.
Yeah, that's right. So that was E.D. And then of course there was Mason, who'd already started to do pioneering work in cloud physics. There was Ludlam, who had come in from the meteorological office without a higher degree, but who ultimately gained a DSC for his work. Marvellous man who had a great feel for the atmosphere and tremendous enthusiasm for conveying this feel to his students. There was Scorer, who was getting interested in physics of flow over mountains, and also who was just starting to be told how to take photographs and develop them in the laboratory. There was Goody, the radiation expert who went off to Blue Hill Observatory. So it was really a quite remarkable bunch.
And you actually did a diploma course, a lecture course.
That's right.
Well, it was very unusual in the British system.
Well, yes, indeed. It's much more like the American system, which I think is extremely good. I was very fortunate to go through that particular course. It was because, of course, there were so many staff there that they could put this on, and we took lectures for the first year, And then accepted the diploma course, as you say, and some other people went on and did another year and got a master's out of it.
But that gave you a year to sort of look around and decide what you might do for research.
Well, yes, it didn't take me quite as long as that, because I went round to various places, including, of course, Romstead, where I talked to Penman, and Penman suggested that the dew might be a suitable topic, because there were people at Romstead working on fungal diseases of potatoes, and they suspected that the wetness of leaves as a result of dew might be an important feature of the spread of the disease. I went out to Stillwood Park, where Imperial College had an outstation, and talked to some of the people there, and one or two other places, but it quickly became apparent that Romstead was really a very good centre for agricultural research. It had a very good tradition. Penman was obviously just coming to the height of his powers, and was a dynamic kind of person, and so I never really spent much time making up my mind on that issue, as far as I remember, and started building equipment for measuring dew and profiles of temperature and wind and so on during my first year as a postgraduate student, in between lectures.
But you weren't going to do that research at Rothamsted, I mean, although Penman came up with perhaps the idea. But
that's right. No, it was much more convenient to do it within easy reach of London. I spent a lot of time in the workshops at Imperial College under the guidance of Ted Jennings, who was in charge there, who helped a lot of students through their PhDs, and he taught me how to use a lathe and a milling machine and things like that, and that was a very, very enjoyable time. And he and I, between us, made a dew balance using a principle that I'd got hold of from L.G. Morris at the what was then the Agricultural Engineering Research Station at Silso. We built this gadget, and I fixed it up with a little optical device so that you could record the very small changes of weight with a light beam on a rotating drum of bromide paper using a barograph drum turned on its side. And in fact we wrote that up and published it in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Meteorological Society, I think, when my second year as a postgraduate. It never occurred to me that it was a little bit unusual for postgraduates to be starting to publish work before they in fact got their thesis out, but that happened. And I also got very interested when I was making the thermocouple psychrometers, and they were unaspirated psychrometers that could be put out at night on a mast, and I got interested in the principles of thermocouple psychrometry and wrote a paper on that, which was published in the Physical
Errors and Accuracy.
Errors and Accuracy in thermocouple psychrometry. And then when all this equipment was ready, we put it in the Imperial College van and took it out to Harlington and dug a big hole in the ground, a bit off the edge of the cricket pitch. Otherwise my name would have been mud. And kept all the equipment in a hut there, and I used to spend the day at Imperial College, and then if the weather looked suitable I would go back to my digs in Ealing and pick up my bike and cycle out to Harlington and set all the equipment up and try to stay awake all night. But I very rarely succeeded in doing that, and if you look at the graphs in the paper, you'll find that there are a number of gaps where I fell asleep and missed the hour's reading.
So while you were doing this work, did you get a lot of support from the other members of staff in doing this long field work, the long hours over the night?
No, I did that entirely on my own. I think the main support I really got was from the people in the workshop. And that was quite invaluable. I couldn't have managed without them. I didn't really get any direction in terms of the design of the experimental work, or the analysis for that matter either. But I don't remember ever feeling that I needed it. I knew what I wanted to do and what I should be doing, and I just got on with it. And I was fortunate that the experiment worked out quite nicely, and in my analysis of the dew measurements, I was able to pinpoint the difference between dewfall and distillation, which hadn't really come out clearly in the literature before then, which had stopped sometime in the 19th century with the work of Aitken and Wells and people like that. I've been interested how in more recently there have been a number of dew papers appearing in the literature. Brimblecombe and his student, for example, published a very, very nice study quite recently on dew and the fact that it has a chemical composition that could be quite important biologically too.
Did you have your supervisors? Can I ask?
Well, yes. Mason did come out once to see the equipment and approve what I was doing. I don't think Shepherd ever came out to the field station, though he was aware of what I was doing. And on one occasion, put me down when I was trying to calibrate my thermocouple psychrometers in the laboratory at Imperial College, and I'd set up a rather complex looking system with water being producing water vapor at a given temperature and then condensing it down and all the rest of it, trying to control the vapor pressure. Shepherd came into the laboratory one day and said, and what's going on here, Monteith? And I told him what was going on. He said, this isn't the National Physical Laboratory, you know. So I was a little bit deflated by that.
What about other work going on in the department at the time? Were some of the other students doing projects on sort of micrometeorology?
Well, yeah, there was only one other in that category, Wally Wilkins from the Met Service in New Zealand, who was doing a master's degree, was measuring turbulence on the big long-wave towers at Rugby. Shepherd was very anxious to get some record of turbulence in the planetary boundary layer, and Wilkins had built a number of recorders for measuring wind direction and wind speed, again just with rotating barograph drums, all we could do in those days, and these were exposed at different heights up to 800 feet on the towers, and he got some very interesting records with these, particularly on the day when the transmitter was accidentally turned on while the things were recording and it burned all the paper in the charts.
So you finished the work at Imperial College,
yeah,
and wrote the paper with the distinction of the shortest
Yes, that's right.
Dew.
Yeah.
I always wanted to do one on fog myself,
there's still time.
And then what? You wanted to continue on in research or go and teach?
No, I never had any idea of teaching at that stage, and it was more or less a foregone conclusion that I would get a job at Rothamsted. And what happened there would never happen now. At the end of my second year as a postgraduate, my DSIR grant of £250 a year came to an end. And I remember writing to Howard Penman and saying, well, I still haven't finished my PhD work and I'd like to get it finished off and I want to get married sometime in the next year or two. Is there any chance of a job at Rothamsted? And Penman immediately fixed this up for me, so I went onto the staff of Rothamsted in my third year as a postgraduate student, continued to work at Imperial College, and just went out to Harpenden from time to time to let Penman know how I was getting on.
So gradually you got the fieldwork finished at Imperial College.
Yeah.
Was that the stage when you finally made the physical move to Rothamsted and to the physics department there?
Yes, that happened in the late summer of 1954, and I moved to Rothamsted along with all my equipment. including the dual balance, which I thought might come in useful someday.
He's travelled a lot with you. It's also at Nottingham.
It was at Nottingham as well. So I got myself established in the physics department, and they were a bit pressed for space at the time when I arrived, so I was sharing the office that Penman had, which was a nice big room looking out over Harpen and Common across the A6. And I think it was very good of him to let me share that room with him, because he'd been accustomed to having it by himself.
Was he a very busy man in managing the department?
Well, at that time, of course, he wasn't the head of department. When I arrived, Schofield, who was a solid physical chemist, was in charge of the department, and he, within a few weeks, I think, of my arriving, was appointed as head of chemistry, succeeding a man called Crowther, who had died the previous year. And then it was a kind of general post. Penman moved from his position as SPSO, or whatever he was at that point, to be head of the physics department, and the head of physics had his own office next to the secretary's office. He moved out of this nice room into a much smaller one, and I got his office. So I did rather well out of that. And I was able to convert that into a little bit of a workshop as well, and had a workbench made so that I could continue making things.
It was a small department though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a pretty small department. There were about, I suppose, four scientific staff, mainly working on aspects of soil physics, soil water, which the department had been involved with since the days of Bernard Keane, who had been the head of department way back in the 1910-1920 era. And then there was still one man who was working on clay crystallography and charges on the basis of clay crystals and things of that kind.
Were most of these sort of projects that Penman had sort of encouraged to develop a theme in the department? Or what was his philosophy?
The philosophy really was something that had been embedded in the department for a long time, because Penman tells in his own biographical notes how he was appointed to the department in 1937, I think it was, and when he arrived, Bernard Keane said to him, well, spend a day or two going around finding out what people are doing, and then decide what you think you'd be interested in yourself and get on with it. And Penman did that very successfully and assumed that everybody else would do it very successfully. Not everybody, of course, survived this particular treatment, and some people rather floundered. Fortunately, I managed to find one or two things that led me into very interesting areas of agricultural meteorology, and it didn't really matter too much that I've been left to make up my own mind where I should go.
Well, let's talk about those one or two things, as you call them.
Yeah.
That could take us some time.
Just to summarise, and I have to try to remember roughly what the sequence was. I continued to be interested in measuring microclimatic factors in the field, and in particular trying to get good measurements of the components of heat balance of crops, because I saw that as being central to the question of what it was that really determined transpiration rates in given weather conditions. And I continued to make instruments for this, using the Wilson and Epps technique that Deakin had picked up and used to make soil heat flux plates, where you wind constantan wire on a former and then electroplate part of it with copper. It really is a very ingenious, simple way of making thermopiles. So I made some flux plates that way and used them, and I also made a little solarimeter that way, and also a ventilated Geer & Dunkel radiometer. This was a black plate with a thermopile embedded in it, so that you could measure the temperature difference between the top and bottom surfaces, and it had to be ventilated, of course, to get a constant heat transfer coefficient. This kind of radiometer was superseded later by the polythene dome type, but it had a number of advantages that the polythene dome type doesn't have, and I often think it was a pity that Geer and Dunkel's system wasn't continued. We made one like that using a quite remarkably robust motor that we bought from the Lyle Street junk shops. In those days you could go down to Lyle Street and buy almost anything from the XRMA, XRAF stores. About that time I finally managed to persuade Penman that I needed somebody to help me in the field and work on the analysis, and he advertised, and we got, I think, only one application, and this turned out to be from a man called Geyser Zeitz, who had been in the meteorological section of the Hungarian Air Force and had fled across the border at the time of the Hungarian uprising, which was 1956, I think, wasn't it? Come to England, not been able to find any work relevant to his experience, and had taken a job as a waiter in the Savoy Hotel. And fortunately, he saw this advertisement, came out. We had no real idea, of course, of his ability, but he seemed to be an energetic, enthusiastic kind of bloke. We appointed him, and that was another marvellous choice forced on us by circumstances, which turned out in the end to be exactly the right thing to do, because he was excellent both at making equipment and getting it running in the field. And you, of course, came across him at a later stage in his career.
That's right. He was he moved later to Canada, and
yeah.
It was a tremendous help to me when I did a sabbatical.
Yeah, yes. What were the other things now that I got involved with instrumentally? Oh yes, there was the thermocouple psychrometer system that Penman suggested I should look at. Someone in the States had developed a method for measuring relative humidity in the range from 98 to 100% over samples of soil kept at a very constant temperature, and this was a way of getting at the water potential of the water held in the soil pores. The problem was you had to operate in this very narrow range, which meant you had to have extremely accurate temperature control and a pretty sensitive kind of thermocouple system. A very ingenious biologist called Spanner, who was in the botany department at Imperial College, decided that one way of getting the water onto a thermocouple was to use it in reverse and to use Peltier cooling to get a drop of water on the thermocouple tip and then reverse the circuit and measure the difference between the wet bulb temperature as shown by the water droplet and the dry bulb temperature of the air. The only problem was that he had devised a system for making his wires, which was fairly fiendish. I've been told that he wanted originally to have a thermocouple small enough to poke through with no little pore. And the smallest gauge of wire you could get was 50 gauge, which was that about a thousandth of an inch or something like that. It was very, very fine. And he had decided that you needed to use some pretty way out alloys in order to get sufficiently high Peltier coefficient. And he used bismuth and tin, melted in a crucible, sucked up into some capillary tubing, and then he drew out the capillary tubing in a Bunsen flame and dissolved the glass in hydrofluoric acid. So I tried this and did succeed in making some of Spanner's alloys, but I realized the dangers of hydrofluoric acid when the glass walls of the fume cupboard that I was working in started to go a little bit hazy. That was a signal that this really was dangerous stuff.
Wisely, you probably realised that Will Hayes adage no longer
worked. That's right, no longer worked under these circumstances. So I remember going along to the library one day and getting out the Handbook of Physics and Chemistry, I think, or the Smithsonian Tables, I forget which, and looking up all the Peltier EMFs of different combinations, and discovering that two quite common substances, or wire materials, constantan and chromel, wouldn't give you nearly as big an EMF as the alloys that Spanner had been using, but they would be good enough. And so I bought some of these and from Johnson Matthey and made them up, and they worked quite well. And in fact, chromel and constantan after that became the standard combination for thermocouple psychrometers. And we had to use, of course, a very constant temperature bath, and it turned out that there was in the department a remarkable mercury thermometer system with electrodes attached to it, which allowed us to keep temperature constant to a thousandth of a degree.
So they weren't using your device for keeping the developing trays at a constant
temperature? No.
That's a bit of a similar sort of idea.
Yes, similar kind of idea. Much safer and much more precise. But in fact, we never really used that. It was just a technique that I developed, and other people in other places took it on later.
Now, the radiation balance work continued for quite a while, and a number of ideas came out of that.
That's right.
Coefficient.
Yes, yes. And in that, I got pretty near to the formula that's used nowadays by the remote sensing people for relating the surface temperature to the heat balance and the surface resistance. But we'll come on to that in a minute. I got interested in the ways in which the different components of the heat balance link together, and the way in which the outgoing long wave changes during the day in phase with the surface temperature and things of that kind.